Well, this must be where the action is today.
I don't know. I've been going 100 per all day. So now we got
to... Now, to be careful how you talk to your senior, dear.
Oh. Katie Johnson, now you're tripping.
What do I...
House State Affairs Committee will come to order. This is January 23rd at 3 p.m. All members of the committee are present. Vice Chair Navarre, Representative Navarre, Representative Miller, Representative Jenkins, Representative Cato, Representative Collins, and Representative Boucher. Those of you who are here, I want to call your attention to please register or sign the sheet outside of the door so we'll be sure to have a record. Even though you may not wish to speak, we'd like to have a record of who is here. I recognize former Representative Rick Urien, who is present today. Welcome. The bills, we have two bills today for consideration. We'll take up House Bill 34 first, an act relating to the limitation of certain times of liquor licenses. The sponsor of the bill, one of the sponsors of the bill, is Representative Miller, and I believe he has some comments to make before we hear from anyone else. I do also recognize, and there may be some others here, but I happen to know that Mr. Shiroff from the ABC Land Board is here to comment on this legislation. And we have three other people who wish to. The rest want to speak to 49. So with that, we'll begin. I said she was here. Okay, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the chance to bring this legislation to people's attention, particularly the committee. I don't think it's any surprise to any person sitting here at this table, or for that matter out in the audience, to know that Alaska's biggest health problem, by any measure, is consumption of alcohol, is alcohol abuse. Not that most of the people who consume alcohol cause the problem, but unfortunately, a large amount of the problems that we face in many other areas are caused because a significantly high, unfortunately, minority does abuse alcohol. We have one of the highest rates, perhaps the highest rate of incarceration in our prisons in the country. And I've heard the percentages, although I can't quote them to you. And they're astounding how high the incarceration rate is by alcohol-related circumstances. Death on the highways is absolutely no surprise to any of us. Violence in the homes because of alcohol abuse is no surprise to us. None of this surprises us. So what do we do? What do we do about it? Do we just pass a law that says from now on everybody is not going to use alcohol? It's foolish to think that anything that naive would work. What has come out of extensive studies over the years is that no one thing works to solve the problem. You can't just get tough on drunk drivers and solve the problem of alcohol abuse on the highways You can't just have an education program in the schools and expect the situation to clear up. But what has been found is that if a number of things are done, and Alaska already has begun to do a number of things along this line, we have cracked down on drunk drivers, for instance. We have raised the drinking age from 18 to 21. We did that last session. And if you do several things, including what is being proposed right here, those things in concert then begin to make a little difference. And I want to emphasize that I am not a do-gooder who is standing here to tell you that if we do this, the situation is just going to be solved. It's the last word we'll have on it. The problem is never going to be solved. a certain irreducible number of people are always going to abuse alcohol. But we can, if we do a number of things, reduce that irreducible minimum we can bring that our problem down to that irreducible minimum. One of the things we can do is make liquor licenses and liquor available in liquor stores and bars less available to the population. How do you do that? Maybe some of us would like to say, well, let's just cut the number of bars we've got in half. We've got too many. I think you could probably make a case that we've got too many. We've got more liquor stores per capita than any other state in the United States. Alaska has a liquor license for every 180 people, you know, give or take a few. U.S. average is one license for every 300. So, you could make a case for abolishing half the licenses. You could make a case for it, but I'd be awfully naive to tell you that there'd be any chance of it passing. I mean, just let's face it, the chances are someplace between zip and zilch. What we can do, however, without paying to anybody, is put a freeze on the number of licenses that would be offered, that would be available from now on, particularly in the category of of a bar license, particularly in the category of a liquor store license. I'm not at all that concerned about wine and beer dispensing in restaurants. Perhaps somebody is, and if they want to investigate it further, I could probably be convinced either way on the issue. But at the present time, my greatest interest, and I think the area needing the greatest attention, is in the area of reducing the number, the per capita of liquor stores and bars per capita. It's just too easy. It's so incredibly easy to find a liquor store in Alaska. I mean, you don't even have to leave the portion of a block you're in half the time. And it's, you certainly don't have to walk very far. And one of the things that studies have shown, there's a particular study called the SMART Report, and it's always the only study I can ever remember the name of because it's such an easy name to remember. The SMART Report says that if you do a whole lot of things, as I just mentioned, including make availability less available, it helps. It doesn't solve the problem, but it helps. It can help a whole lot. By putting a freeze on the number of liquor stores and the freeze on the number of bars in the state, we're not going to help the problem a bit tomorrow or next week. But as Juneau's population grows, as Anchorage's population grows, as everybody's population grows, then the percentage of stores per capita begins to descend, and we will become a little bit closer to the national average. Not that I'm just enthralled with the national average. I don't care if we're 50 over it or 50 under it. I'm not striving for numbers. What I think that we should be striving for is just making it not so bloody easy for anybody just to wander almost by accident or almost on the slightest impulse into a bar or into a liquor store. By the same token, we shouldn't make it so difficult they can't find one. But believe me, we under the present circumstances and under the terms of this bill, we'll never in Alaska face that problem. People will always be able to find a liquor store without any difficulty whatsoever. The bill basically does two things. It takes the present per capita requirement, which says you can have one liquor store and you can have one bar for every 1,500 people, and it raises it to 3,000. In other words, no more liquor stores and no more bars would be authorized in Alaska, or I should say in a given community, until they come up from the present one for every 1,500 up to one for 3,000. Now suppose gold is discovered down at Taku Harbor and a city of 3,500 springs up. Okay, they will be entitled to a liquor store and to a bar because they have they will have the requisite population. So we're not precluding under any circumstances. Or take a town that right now only has two of each category. And if, because of an oil boom or any other boom for that matter, or coal whatsoever, if their population explodes, then they too will, under the terms of the thing, be able to have liquor stores and bars as soon as they hit the right threshold. But overall, and in the main, the number of liquor stores in Alaska will remain basically the same. We have experienced here in Juneau a population semi-explosion. And boy, what a signal honor it is. It was announced to us that we're now entitled to more bars and liquor stores. What a wonderful thing that was reach that new entitlement threshold. Frankly, I think we need more bars and liquor stores in Juneau, like we need a hole in the head. But, you know, the law is there right now, one for every 1,500, and so the entitlement is there. Somebody's applied for them, I presume. I presume they're going to get them. And fine, nothing wrong with it. It's the law, you know. But my proposal is that we change the law. Maybe that horse is already out of the barn, but at least we will have solved the problem. In the drafting process, I talked to Mr. Chirac this morning of the ABC board, Alaska Beverage Control Board, and he identified an area that I had not meant to, an area of the bill that, where I goofed in the drafting process. I guess the way we drafted the bill originally, we had wiped out the public convenience license, not only for bars and liquor stores, but we'd also wiped it out for beer and wine establishments in connection with the restaurant. That was not the intention. As I say, I don't really have all that much of a problem. If somebody wants to have a glass of beer, or a bottle of wine, or a glass of wine or whatever with their dinner, I don't have that much of a problem, and I don't think that contributes to the terrible problem that I think most of us are addressing. So it was not my intention to wipe out that portion of the public convenience license. However, the second thing this does, in addition to setting this new threshold, it wipes out the public convenience section, wherein the ABC board can, over and above all the quotas and over and above everything else, if they decide that there's a public convenience reason to do so, issue additional licenses. Now, let me hasten one thing to say. I have no problem with the public convenience licenses that have been issued so far. The board has acted reasonably, I think. We've got a good, conscientious, ethical board in place at the present time, and as far as I know, the boards in the past have been in that category. But particularly, if we put this freeze on, I think there's going to be absolutely horrendous, humongous pressure put to establish some of these so-called public convenience licenses. And I think the board will find itself under all sorts of pressure, and you might even have the invitation in the future. And I certainly have not even the breath of accusation that anybody would take it, but you have those situations where there could be a wild temptation on the part of some unsavory character to even offer money under the table in order to get one of these public convenience licenses. As I say, I don't have any problem at all with it for the beer and wine thing, but I don't think we should be issuing them in the future for the bars and liquor stores, particularly if we're going to put otherwise a freeze on. Finally, this legislation does one other thing. It takes the so-called tourist facility license. Right now, in order to encourage tourism, and I think one of the top boosters of tourism in this legislature, it says that if you have a hotel with 10 rooms, you can have a licensed premises on the premises, a bar, for instance, for your hotel. Frankly, I think 10 is too little. Again, I don't think people have abused it in the past, but I see a tremendous, particularly if this bill passes, I see a tremendous opportunity for abuse in the future where somebody can buy 10 dilapidated trailers, put them in a semicircle around the back, call it the OK Corral Roundup Bar and or hotel, and never open up the trailers and automatically get a license. Under the standards of the present ABC board, that's not going to happen. I just like to preclude problems that I see in the future. I've raised that minimum from 10 rooms up to 50, but I hasten to say that number should probably be negotiable and flexible. Mr. Schrock tells me that the board has already identified this same problem, and have been talking in terms of regulations which would allow them some flexibility, that, for instance, in a small town where you probably would never get a 50-room hotel, small community, you might want to put, instead of 10, you might want to put it at 15, 17, or something like that. In a medium-sized community, you might want to make it 35. And in a large city, Fairbanks or Anchorage style, you might want to have it, a 50-room hotel would be the threshold. They're looking at that, and of course, this bill's got a long ways to go before it sees passage. The 50 that I've got in here is not, cast in stone at all, and I'd look at any figures anybody has or any suggestions that people have to make that figure more flexible and more logical, if it isn't totally logical right now. Madam Chair, as I say, I had left out, in the earliest draft, the one that the bill, we needed to have the public convenience license applied to beer and wine at the old 1,500 per capita figure. And that's what this committee substitute that is before you does. I ask Mr. Edwards, the drafter of that legislation, to come over, because the one thing I've found in dealing with this legislation is that when you get into this title and this subject, it's nothing is ever simple. If you know, it seems like you ought to just make a simple determination of a simple thing you want to do, and you can just write a simple little bill to do it. And in this subject area, it's impossible. I mean, to accomplish the the relatively simple thing I wanted to do, it was necessary, and I know it was necessary to give you additional pages.
Is this? You want to submit this as a substitute for yours?
I submit it to the committee as a for their consideration as a committee substitute. Maybe there's other things that the committee is going to want to do as well. And
so you'd rather have us consider this one than the original?
Yeah. Yes, because it more accurately reflects my intent. Although, if you've done your homework and read the first one, then now I'm giving another thing if you haven't had a chance to read. But it essentially does almost everything the same as the first one does, but it does have an extra element.
Thank you, Representative Miller. To save time for the other bill that we might get to today, I was hoping that we would be able to just divide the time. So perhaps at this point we could hear from Mr. Shirock, and if there are any questions of the drafter, committee members could direct them after we hear from Mr. Shirock. I did want to say that I believe and agree with you that 10-room motel should be changed. In my area, just in the last 18 months, there have been 4 new bars started, and using the 10-room, they're bringing in portable buildings and just to meet the 10-room requirement. In fact, there are 3 restaurants within a few hundred yards of each other, all have liquor licenses now, right on the park's highway. And I like you, am not a person who's against having alcohol available with meals, but I do think that this is abuse of that law, that regulation. I would like to see someone be able to use some discretion so that we don't have them all right together like that. But you don't like to get in the way of businesses, and I know that they do need, very often, to make a restaurant survive, you do need a beer and wine license. But I think that there is, in a growing area such as we have, a chance for more difficulties and benefits to the public. With that, I'd like to have Mr. Shirock, the Executive Director of the Alaska Beverage Control Board.
Before Mr. Shirock sits down, let me just make one last quick thing. Let me tell you what's wrong with this bill. And the biggest thing wrong with it is that it will probably double, triple, perhaps quadruple the value of existing licenses. I mean, we're making many, M-I-N-I, millionaires, perhaps, out of the people that have existing licenses. And I'm sorry about that. That's an unfortunate circumstance, in a sense. But that die was cast back when the first draft of the first bill in this title was done, and they said that becomes personal property. So there's nothing to do about it. You just recognize that as a demerit. There's pros and cons to every bill. That's the biggest argument against this bill. To me, all the good of the bill offsets that by far, but I just want to go in admitting that that's a fault, but I don't see any way in the world you can get around it. So that's just, the way it is.
Could I?
Yes, Ms. Representative Kaye.
Could I ask a question before, Mr. Shirock? On the 10 rooms type situation, what would occur, say, that someone built a lodge out on Glacier Island, for instance, and they could just build a 10-room lodge, and if you'll notice, a lot of your lodges aren't any larger than that, then they could not have a liquor license?
No, that...
Well,
I wouldn't want that to happen.
Well, this is one thing I wanted to point out.
This is where I said I am amenable to some flexible looking at in this area. I'm trying to avoid the abuse that Chairman Hurley identified from her own community. On the other hand, there are, you know, needs, and I think maybe the ABC board is looking at that very problem. They recognize the very problem. They're working on it, and I think we can probably arrive at some language that will accommodate, you know, the problem you just identified, as well as the abuse problem that the rest of us are concerned with.
Representative Boucher.
I think it's going to be a long one, and I welcome it. I support what you're talking about. We've seen it in our own district. You've got to put a quick stop in everybody's backyard, but the best way to stop that is no liquor license. That quick stop's not feasible. We just got through that, particularly in the new sections of Anchorage. And I'm really interested in this one. I think unless we take what may be unpopular in some areas right by the horn and do it fairly, otherwise we can pour all the money we want into drunk driving and what have you, you know. I'm interested to see what's coming by. Support your concept on the thing early on.
Now, Mr. Shirov, would you please, since this is on tape, would you please give your name and your title for the record so the voice they'll know that you're speaking?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Shirok. I'm director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. I'll try not to be redundant with what Representative Miller said. I think he's covered most of the points that the bill covers. Just for clarification, though, I want to make sure that what you said earlier about the restaurant thing, the restaurant limitation, I haven't seen your proposed amendment.
We just got it minutes ago. But
the point that came strikingly home to me last Thursday or Friday as I was reviewing the bill was that the present language raises or eliminates the limitation for restaurant and eating place licenses totally. And I think Representative Miller addressed that, but that's one of the significant, I think, aspects of the current version. There are a couple of minor amendments that I could propose, but I think more importantly, from what I hear being discussed among the committee members, the board has been trying to address these issues over the last 3 or 4 years. And one element is the room provision that Representative Miller is providing for in the bill. The board would prefer that it have discretion to structure the room requirements for these kinds of facilities. We sent a letter to every municipality in the state last June announcing to them a proposed idea, structuring the number of room requirements for tourist facilities based on the population in that particular area. And the maximum, I believe, for populations over 55,000, the room requirement under the board scheme would be 60 rooms, between 50 and 60 rooms. This February 20th, the board will be here in Juneau to discuss a proposed discussion draft of that regulation. In addition to that, they'll be discussing seating requirements for restaurants licensed premises. That their theory there is also to base the seating requirement based on population of a particular community or area. Last year the board was supportive of the approach for raising the population limitations on license issuance. Their discussion last year was in the realm of raising it from anywhere to 2,000 to 2,500 persons per license of each type. Just stating it bluntly, the current version of the bill would, in Anchorage, for example, require that the population raise somewhere in the neighborhood of 444,000 persons before another beverage dispensary license or beverage store license could be issued. But that's another area the board has certainly been wrestling with. The public convenience aspect that Representative Miller addressed earlier, the current version repeals that. The board would prefer to be allowed some discretion under the current provision of the law to grant licenses. In the 4.5 years of the existence of that provision in law, the board has only granted 5 licenses. There's 2 here in Juneau, 1 in the Kenai Peninsula, 1 in Kodiak, and I can't remember where the other one is. that the board feels that it doesn't, it's not appropriate to completely close the door for allowing businesses to go into business. I think what the board is trying to address is the caliber of business that desires to have a license. And through the regulatory scheme, the board is going to try and address that. I don't know if some, you may have heard that the board is in the throes exploratory stage of discussing using the public convenience provision in law now to grant licenses to restaurants, which would be, I guess you might say, full service restaurants where there wouldn't be a bar, alcoholic beverages would be served only by a waiter or waitress, and there wouldn't be any facility for patrons of an establishment to sit and just drink. The board, particularly here in Juneau, last year, went through quite a process of reviewing restaurant applications. As Representative Miller said, the population raised up, so there was room for four more restaurants here in Juneau. And the board went through a competitive process to consider those applications.
May I ask a question?
Surely.
Did you just say that the board is thinking of just having licenses where people just sit and no place for them to just, that they have to have food?
Yes.
That to me is sort of elitist, though, because that means that, you know, in some small communities where you have kinds of activities where you don't, it's a recreation, then you have make this feeling of having to be, you know, very dressed up and so forth. You wouldn't be able to have that kind of fellowship that a lot of people like to have in these coastal towns. And yeah. I would hate to see that kind of. I think there needs to be more flexibility, but I would, you know, that maybe the board could. That I would hate to see that it only. That some of those establishments would not be able to exist, and it would take away from the flavor of Alaska in some of these communities.
You're absolutely correct, but the provision that the board is looking to grant the license is the public convenience provision in law, where the board would only be granting a license over and above the number of licenses that would already be allowed by law. So it will be an exception issuance of a liquor license. The board would assume that there are adequate other kinds of licenses in the community already serving the public. That's their approach. There was one other provision I didn't mention to Representative Miller this morning either. I think there probably should be some provision for an effective date. And the reason I say that is because if there's a new limitation and the law or bill were to become law within 90 days after signature, I think my office would be deluged with applications prior to the effective date of the new law. And I think, Madam Chair, that concludes my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any members have questions? Mr. Schirock?
Yeah, I followed you on the problem with the effective date causes, but what's the solution? What would you suggest for an effective
immediate
date? Make it an immediate
emergency
effective
calls.
Date. Okay, that's okay.
Representative Jenkins?
Yes, Pat, you mentioned 2,000 to 2,500, and in the proposed bill is 3,000. Were there any rationales for the 2,000 to 2,500?
That's a tough one. I think I testified last year that there's really no magic number, and I think the board's thought was that a number larger than that would so prolong the ability for any licenses to be issued that it might almost be unreasonable. Because I think the way the bill was structured last year and the way this version is this year, that there wouldn't be any licenses issued for a long time to come. And I understand that's certainly the intent. But the board feels that it's faced with many persons who come before it saying, number one, I can't get a license because I can't afford to buy one. And there's no vehicle anywhere for the board to have discretion to grant a license. And that's why it's suggesting to retain the public convenience provision of the law. But I do appreciate Representative Miller's concerns for abuse of that, because it's potentially there.
Are there any available licenses in Anchorage today?
No.
What's the process by which additional licenses would be granted?
right now the process is for me, under the board's current regulations, to certify a change in population by March 31st, which I will do. From my preliminary look at population changes for the municipality of Anchorage, there will probably be room for one beverage dispensary license and possibly 8 or 10 restaurant licenses. I will have to correct what I said, though. There is room for package store licenses.
Is there, would there be a way that you could have a regulation leaving the 10-room stand, but have some kind of study or plan setting out that really the tourists, because it does say for tourist purposes, that it really showed that it was tourist traffic that was going to improve and that was what the rooms were needed for. Do you think that would be enforceable and to be able to leave the 10 there, but still have the board have some control over of why they needed, 10 rooms? Because a lot of these were establishments that were there for years, restaurants.
What the board's concerned about under the current environment in Alaska with the growing population, that they believe that applicants only make an application with the minimum requirement for the sole purpose of getting a liquor license. It's not to say that the board doesn't have the authority to deny that application, but if they do, then we're appealing and going on and on, and it isn't worth the time or the effort or expense of everyone concerned. So that's the reason the board has come up with this idea of graduating the number of rooms based on the population.
Have you talked with the lawyers if that's, would that be enforceable? I mean, would there be any challenge to that if you had that kind of a regulation?
The board, that's a tough one to answer. The law says minimum of 10 rooms.
Yeah, and that's what they use.
And the board certainly has, under the law, the ability to develop and promulgate regulation. And our attorney has not advised the board that they couldn't do it. And as I said, on February 20th, the board will be looking to really adopt the discussion draft. My secretary tells me has been completed, and I'll be mailing copies to the legislators between now and then, probably by the end of this week. So you'll be able to get a feel for what the language is.
Representative Miller?
Just to throw out while Mr. Schrock's in there, the statistics I'm going to quote you are a year old, and they'll be heading 1985 statistics shortly. But for instance, even a year ago, Mr. Schrock says that under the 1-for-3,000 formula, that Anchorage would have to have 400,000 plus population, which is unquestionably true. But right now, if they didn't get another license, or even as of 1984, if they didn't get another license for the next 30 years, they've got 146 beverage dispensaries and bars in Alaska, and 124 liquor stores, and apparently there's even some liquor stores mentioned available. So I appreciate what Mr. Schrock's saying, but I don't think there's a dearth of liquor stores, even if we didn't, we made this 1-for-6,000. In Fairbanks, there are right now 44, or in January of 1984, there were 44 beverage dispensary licenses and 24 package stores. My hometown here, I guess it's either 27 or 28 bars, 16 liquor stores. Going into Valdez, there were 9 bars already and 5 liquor stores. Wasilla, as of the first of the year, and it sounds like there's more since, there were 6 bars and 2 package liquor stores. So, as I say, if we change this from 1 to 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000, I still don't think you'd have to look around or walk very far to, find a watering hole. And so that's kind of why I provided the 3,000, although I appreciate the position of the ABC board last year and appreciate their, support of the bill, even though they're a little bit different than our statistical requirements.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to give Representative Miller just a hint that the city limits of Valdez are 23 miles. So you'd have to walk quite a far to get a watering hole sometimes.
Back in my drinking days when I was in Valdez, I didn't have to go very far no matter where I was.
We just extend our city limits to 23 miles.
Okay, very good. Of course, ours would not have to talk too hard.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to add one more comment to Representative Miller's recitation of what the statistics were and basically are. The thrust that the board has been trying to communicate is that under the current law, there is a strong responsibility for local governing bodies to participate in this application process, to include renewal applications and applications for new licenses. And I know in some small communities, even large communities, the deliberation over an application is difficult. That the current, all license fees that are submitted to the state by applicants are refunded to those incorporated communities for the sole purpose of enforcing liquor laws. Some, because there aren't very many licenses in some communities, the dollar amount certainly isn't that much. But the perspective I'm trying to bring in here is that there's a lot of participation in the review of liquor license applications, and maybe what I'm saying, there should be some diligence in that direction also. It's not necessarily the board, or it's not necessarily this area or group of people that have, I guess you might say, allowed the proliferation of licenses to continue. But I just say that for what it's worth.
Thank you. Anyone? Mr. Representative Jenkins?
I have a couple more. Going along the, what besides the family stat are the parameters of an additional license? Is there a population basis or community?
There's no population. The only other criteria under the law is that a dining facility also be in the premises. Or in place of that, a majority of the rooms have dinettes or facilities within those rooms. But the thrust of it is, there has to be either new construction or improvement to a facility, and that through issuance of the license and by that new construction or improvement, it will encourage tourism.
Does that count against the population?
No. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. I'm sorry.
After it's granted.
After it's granted. The public convenience license does not count against the limitation.
Can you suggest also that you also suggested that probably there wouldn't be any question of discriminatory legislation if it went 10 to 30 to 40, if it gave the board the discretion related to the size of the community in terms of it wouldn't have to go from 10 to 50.
No, I don't think there would be any discretion, no.
Representative Boucher?
Yes, I think it's generally recognized that we lead the nation in alcoholism-related problems. Unfortunately. But in other areas, where do we rank in number of liquor licenses per population? I don't think you covered that.
I didn't, but I don't
have
that.
Where are those figures available?
Surely.
Where do we rank?
Number one.
We are number one. We seem to lead in all the wrong things.
U.S. average is 1 for 300. We're 1 for 180.
Okay.
I think the reason that gets lopsided, too, if I may, Madam Chair,
yes.
Take Representative Miller cited Ketchikan, for example, having 23 or 24 bars. If you were to look at that population, I think he would only be allowed to issue 7 or 8. But this goes back into statutory allowances that were in existence a number of years ago, which has since been repealed. And a lot of those licenses are exception licenses, not a great number of them, but a number of them are that were issued under the exceptions we've talked about here, meaning the tourism or the hotel and motel provisions.
Any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Sherrod.
Thank you very much for your courtesy.
Is there anyone else here who would like to comment on this legislation? Would you come forward, please? Could you give your name and...
Sure.
Madam Chairman, my name is Matt Felix, and I'm the coordinator of the State Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. As a main part of my duties, I have to pick up the casualties through our treatment programs of the high numbers that you heard in per capita consumption recently. This state drinks virtually twice as much as a national average, nearly 5 gallons of absolute alcohol for everybody over the age of 19. That means that the average person in the state drinks about 97 gallons of beer, 35 quarts of whiskey a year. Those figures get even more dramatic if you look into where and why they're drank. And it turns into some sad statistics when you look at what I have to do, and that is pick up the casualties. I would like to comment and really compliment Representative Miller on this type of legislation, because I think my office is fighting a losing battle, and I don't think we're ever going to solve the alcoholism situation in this state, as rapid as it is, probably for the next 20 years. We've had 20 years of unregulated, virtually, issuance of licenses, and we'll suffer another 20 years for that. I think that some of the solutions to our problem are not in terms of our, unfortunately, my office and treatment. It's this type of legislation. It's time we take the bull by the horns and really meet this problem head on legislatively. And in the past, that's been almost impossible. I would like to speak to this particular bill in some areas that I think I heard today of concern to me. I would hope and encourage this committee not to allow the board discretion in the areas of issuing licenses for different size communities, primarily because their discretion hasn't been prudent in the past. Not necessarily because they're devious or have some other purpose in mind, but the political pressure or the local pressure on the board has been such that in the end, the licensee or the applicant always wins. I can give you a number of examples right here in Juneau. I resided here in Juneau for 6 years and developed the alcoholism treatment program here before I became a state employee working the state. I fought a number of liquor licenses here. Some of the applicants had a storm about half the size of this room, which also included a sandwich shop. On the third appeal, I lost. The individual got a liquor license, an off-sale license, opened up a store in a corner for about 2 months, and then sold the license. There's no enforcement of that, no stopping of that process once they get the license. The board does not have any really regulatory ability. It only has 5 agents statewide, so those kind of things happen. Some of the restaurant licenses that are issued require, for an example, 50% of the income of the restaurant be from food, not alcohol. And they are given a license. Nobody comes back and checks to see if 50% of their income is food. They either turn the thing into a semi-bar or sell the license. And I would also, in particular with this bill, if you're going to allow the board discretion, say, to open up a hotel with 10 rooms or less, or 10 rooms or close to 10 on Glacier Island, limit the board's ability, or limit that licensee to transfer that license out of Glacier Island. And that's what's happened a lot. People have gone and gotten these licenses under this ratio that exists today, and then made a profit on them in some other area of the borough. So if somebody is going to get a hotel license or a tourist license for Glacier Island, make it stay on Glacier Island, or give it back to the state. I think this, you'll find a great deal of public support for this bill. It's long overdue, and the testimony we heard this past year through our board meetings, through the Drunk Driving Task Force, the Governor's Task Force on Drunk Driving, the response we've had to the awareness campaigns, I can assure you the people of this state are just sick and tired of the alcoholism problem.
Thank you for your statement.
I'd like to, if you don't mind, George Mundell from my office has worked on this particular bill, and I'd like to give him a few minutes, if you don't mind. Can
sure.
I transfer much here?
Points have already been made of what was going to be addressed in the department's position. Basically, that Alaska does have about twice the number of licensed outlets as the norm below in the lower 48. This probably would have been a priority issue. With the recent meeting of the governor's statewide task force on drunk driving, however, the task force was informed by its chairman, Clarkson, that this bill was in the works, and under the process they used to prioritize their issues, they decided not to deal with this because they felt it was being dealt with, but it would have been an issue with that body had Representative Miller's bill not been underway. This whole motion, it's been mentioned, is part of a national trend. I mean, there are people like Mothers Against Drunk Driving. There are various students against drunk driving. There certainly is a whole new group of parents action committees. There's Ketchikan Families in Action, the National Association of Federation of Parents. And I think there's an entire grassroots movement that is really getting up in arms about alcohol abuse in general. And there certainly is a tremendous interest in these types of, if you will, moderation measures. And these are the results of other grassroots organizations like the Chemical People, which had quite a presence in Alaska, and their voluntary efforts. And people basically are just saying they've had enough in certain areas, and they want to look at strategies to reduce the incidence and prevalence of alcohol-related problems. And so I think there are three states now that are outlawing happy hours, as an example.
So I beg your pardon, George.
Happy hours. Happy hours. The governor of Massachusetts, I believe, Illinois, and Texas are all looking at that strategy. Certainly others are looking at limiting number of licenses and age, and I think some of the other things have already been said. But I think that, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Could you send us a statement from the task force that you were in support of this legislation that we could use for the committee?
I could certainly talk with the chairman of it, Representative Claxton.
And any other organizations that would be good for the record for the committee? Your statement, if you could write it out.
Sure.
Any questions? Representative Jenkins?
I think I have one for Mr. Felix. You're suggesting that the ABC board not be allowed any discretion in the size of rooms. You said political pressure, transferring leases. What was the other?
The appeal process that is allowed under those regulations make it so cumbersome that the board almost always folds.
I think we've seen that in Anchorage several times.
Representative Navarre?
Madam Chairman, if the board's not allowed discretion, then would that force the number of rooms to be lowered, maybe even artificially for some communities, in order to allow some of the communities to receive a license such as that based on their population?
Well, I'm not saying not to let the board issue no licenses for small communities. I'm just saying don't give them the discretion to issue those licenses under this present regulation to then allow it to be transferred all over, sold, and all the maneuvering they can do under the present regulations.
Mr. Navarre?
Madam Chairman, would you suggest then that we structure the numbers to population within a community?
Yes, I would, and to comment, to add upon Representative Miller's comments, I really don't think that the licenses are going to double in price in the near future because there's so darn many of them right now. There's a number of licenses for sale that can't be sold. Now, eventually, I agree that those will up, and that's a sad thing about this bill. But there's been 20 years of issuances of 16, I think it is, categories of licenses, and there's just so many that's out there.
Plus the grandfathering.
Plus the territorial government grandfathering a number of them.
Mr. Sherrod, excuse me, can a license be transferred from one community to another?
No.
I didn't think so.
No. The board passed a regulation last April. Just to clarify that. Any new licenses issued by the board or granted by the board after that date could not be transferred for a full year. The board recognized exactly what Matt was saying. But the most they would go at that time was a year. That certainly didn't put any prohibition on licenses issued prior to that time. The second point, if I may, licenses issued to facilities under the exception for the rooms cannot be transferred to another location.
Mr. Jenkins, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would appreciate if Commissioner Sherrod would impart to me what the average value of an Anchorage license is worth today.
I can only really describe to you what I read in the paper, but I would have to say that I'm pretty familiar with the license that sold a year or so ago for $400,000.
And I'm thinking in terms of the municipality of Anchorage, we have communities down the Seward Highway and up the Eagle Riverway, and of course a license can be transferred anywhere within our community going through the amount of hoops, but I would suggest that $450,000 and that would get larger very quickly in my community.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. I believe that if there's no one else to comment on this legislation, that we should, since we have another bill scheduled, we should hold this over and discuss it further. We're not, I don't believe, ready to, because of amendments, possible amendments and so forth, that we should discuss this at another meeting. And so I would like to take a 3-minute break so we can get ready for the hearing House Bill 49. Porter, we have before us on the calendar House Bill number 49, an act relating to limitations on campaign financing. The sponsors are Representative Miller of Juneau and Representative Duncan. This time, perhaps you could give us a short statement. Unfortunately, we do have to adjourn this meeting at 4:30 promptly because several of this committee must attend the meeting on the asbestos legislation.
Which is start right at 4:30.
Mm-hmm. I can be pretty brief, Madam Chair, because this, unlike the liquor legislation, is actually pretty simple. We heard the other day from Senator Fisher and others about the cost of campaigning. We all know the hard way what the cost of campaigning are. They're absolutely outrageous what it costs, and I don't think the public is well served by, for instance, a house seat costing $150,000 or so. That's just, to me, unacceptable. We can't put an absolute limit on the spending. The Constitution says we can't. We can, however, put an absolute limit on spending that's funded with state dollars. Our present campaign credit program, wherein if I donate $100 to Red's campaign, I can get my $100 back at the end of the year from the state. We can say that for Red to receive my state-funded contribution, he has to sign a statement in advance saying, in this case, that he's going to limit his cost to $50,000. If he was a senator, it would be limited to $75,000. If he was a lieutenant governor, it would be limited to $500,000. If he was a governor candidate, it would be limited to $750,000. That's what this does. This doesn't say you can't spend as much as you want, but it says if you're going to use state reimbursement monies, then you can't spend as much as you want. You can only spend up to this limit. That's the bill in a nutshell.
Thank you. We have two people who wish to speak to this, and we have a statement in your folder from Theda Pittman, who is the Executive Director of the Public Offices Commission. And if you won't object, Representative Martin, I'd like to have her speak first. Since we do have a statement, perhaps you can summarize it for us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Theda Pittman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Offices Commission. It's always a relief to me when I get something written because then I don't feel like I have to get bogged down in every detail of it. I would like to mention a couple of things for those of you who may be unaware of it. A member of the commission, Gene Rogers, who's currently the vice chair of the commission, lives here in Juneau. And Mrs. Rogers, I had lunch with Mrs. Rogers today, and we talked about whether she might come to the committee meeting. She asked me to indicate to you that since she does live here in Juneau, she would be happy to come anytime there's an issue that comes up that you all would like to speak to a member of the commission about directly. Most of the material that I have prepared deals with administrative matters relative to the proposal. There is some sentiment among the commission that an issue like whether such a proposal should be enacted is appropriately a matter for consideration between the public and its elected officials, and that the commission as the administrator, perhaps that's not an ideal topic for the commission to try to take a commission position on. But indeed, the kinds of things that I've raised in the paper do have to do with questions that would come up if the bill as proposed were enacted, and some questions I simply asked about what would your reaction be to this or that. For instance, what happens if a person files the statement, accepts contributions, and never runs for office? Is that a matter of concern to you? Is that something that you want to, make any kind of provision about? I also suggest that something that I'm beginning to call the policy of, when a person starts acting like a candidate, it would be desirable if the legislation said that they were required to report like a candidate under the campaign disclosure law, and that they were subject to its provisions with regard to limitations on contributions, properly identifying material, that sort of thing. And so I've kind of integrated that suggestion as well. I think, as many of you are aware, truly the biggest difficulty the Commission has had in the last 10 years is that skyrocketing of campaign activity and a real unstable, fluctuating budget at a level that's terribly, terribly low in response to our workload. And frankly, it's beginning to show up now because the fiscal year 84 budget was a horrible one, and we took terrible cuts. Now we're beginning to see the effects of that in terms of people who are saying to us, well, why didn't you do this, and why didn't you do that for me? And the answer is because we didn't have decent funding, and then the 84 campaigns came along. And in fact, some of the enforcement activity, the complaints and things like that, which I also point out that if you start talking about limiting expenditures, people are going to start asking the commission, well, is this considered an expenditure? That wasn't really an expenditure, it was constituent communication. Or that sort of, those kinds of questions will start popping up. And the formal complaints, which the commission is required by law to address, will require things like field audits. Bring your books and records so we can see if indeed those things were reported. There are several attachments. The attachments I think you may find interesting. I hope you'll find interesting just for background information and for your reference about the 1984 campaigns, for instance, and the history of commission bills in the last 5 years or bills affecting the commission. There's some material that I thought you might like. And the last page is a chart that shows the relative positioning of the commission's budgets over the years with expenditures by house campaigns. And anytime I can answer questions or provide information for you, I'd be pleased.
And do you have a question, Representative Boucher?
Yes. I noticed that there's been a recommendation here that raised the contribution limit to $2,000 in the past and to $250. Have you given thought to that?
Sure. I've given thought to that, but frankly, I'd just soon not get that mixed in with this bill. I've spent a legislative career watching bills relative to APOC go down the tube. And if I could just keep this real simple so that we can do this, I don't support the raising of 250, for instance, but that's a small point. I mean, I recognize the value of the argument that APOC and others use for it. And I would certainly be happy to, either on this committee or the Judiciary Committee, you know, draft some of that language so we can consider it separately. But I would like to keep this bill as limited to the subject of campaign limits as possible so it doesn't get bogged down with, for instance, since I don't support the raising of the $100 to $250, I might have to vote against my own bill because I just think $250 is too high a figure.
What about the $1,000 to $2,000?
Well, it's the same principle. I mean, I think there's legitimate arguments to be made for that. You know, I finally come down and don't vote for them, but I think they're legitimate, and I think they'll be studied. But I just assume not have them studied in this bill. I suggest we study it on another bill, and I think it's very legitimate that particularly this committee do so. But I would like to, you know, just identify areas that the APOC sees as problems in the area of campaign expenditure limitations, and limit this bill to that subject.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chairman, I might explain that. I wanted to include that so that, to sort of buttress my statement that the Commission does recognize there are problems with existing law, and that in the context of that, those were the items that they wanted brought up for discussion at the time, and not necessarily because it was a suggestion.
I'm sure we'll be calling on you many times in the course of the session and the next session also. I'm one who really believes that you don't have the kind of a budget to do the job that you're supposed to do, and hope that that can be rectified some of this session. This time, did you have a question? I'm sorry.
Yes, I have a question.
Representative Collins has a question of the...
You indicated that the limit is 50,000 What I'd like to know is how did you come up with that figure of 50,000 or whatever your limit dollar limit is that you set? What criteria did you use to come up with a number? And there are some situations in which putting a dollar limit on it would create some problems for some of the people, and depending on the size of their district.
Well, first of all, there's no magic in the number 50,000, 75,000, what it is in here. And you're right, costs vary tremendously in different districts. In some of the northern districts, advertising may be zero for a candidate, but they may absorb 45 to 50,000 just in airfares flying around the villages. So there's no magic to it, and if you can come up with a better figure, it just seemed to me that that's around the figure that most candidates could get elected by spending. And, you know, I didn't want to short them too much, because then the public suffers. You should allow a candidate to spend enough money to get the information out. And I recognize that, for instance, in Anchorage, you've got a much more difficult problem, because you've got a whole bunch of television stations. This last election, we've had the choice of stations now. We used to just have one station, so it was relatively cheap for us to be on television. Now, if you're going to get coverage, you've got to be on several channels. Mm-hmm. And we've got more radio stations now, which is a problem you face in Anchorage. But even so, it just seemed to me that $50,000 wasn't a bad figure at all, that a person ought to be able to. And it's a great equalizer. I mean, everybody is going to face the same problem. The bad news for the non-incumbent is the incumbent already has name identification. The good news for the non-incumbent is this keeps the incumbent from having easy access to additional monies that a non-incumbent can get. So there's checks and balances on the whole system, and it just seemed to me like the $50,000, $75,000. I see the Senator Halford introduced similar legislation in the Senate, and his prices or his limits are not the same, but they're in that ballpark. Mm-hmm. And the governor's thing probably sounds especially low, but you've got to remember that once the primary is out of the way, the governor and lieutenant governor can sort of combine their pool, and so they actually have more than $1 million to spend.
Representative Navarre.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a question regarding whose responsibility it would be for refunds if a candidate, when he first decided to run for office, agreed to these constraints, and then at some point in the campaign decided that the other person was attempting to buy the election and felt it was necessary to expend more money in order to get elected. Also,
short answer is there wouldn't be any refunds. Once you make your decision, you're stuck with it.
Well then what about, it says here under B, that you shall advise the contributor at the time of accepting. If he accepts it early in the campaign with the understanding, or gives it early in the campaign with the understanding that he's going to get a refund, maybe...
If you send me $10 or $100, my obligation is to either send you back notification that I'm contributing under the terms of this legislation and you will get a refund, or send you back your money.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is that you might think, you know, that at the time decide to run, but later on in the campaign it might become necessary, and then if you're faced with $50,000 or $75,000 that you solicited by using that as a means to get the card.
You don't have that option. You make your mind up, and that's the name of the game.
Okay, then, one other question, please, Madam Chair.
Well, I wanted to get to Representative Martin. I'm worried about, could you ask the question of Tim Miller?
It'll be real quick. How is the, would this bill be affected by PACs or other special interest groups, particularly political parties, depending on a campaign?
If people contribute to a PAC with the expectation of getting their money back, whoever the PACs pass that money on to has to get one of these commitments. In other words, if state employee X contributes to EPIC, and then EPIC can't give me any money, with the expectation of getting the money back, and that's the way the PACs raise their money for the most part. EPIC can't give me any money unless I sign one of those things.
Well, how about?
I mean, they could give me money if they want to, but they don't get a refund on it.
Representative Martin, I apologize for making you wait.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Terry Martin, and I've been highly interested for a long time in state money being used for campaign, political campaigns. Basically, I would have to disagree with my good friend, Representative Miller. It's not a simple answer to what I would agree with as a major problem of outrageous costs toward political campaigns. I think that history bear me out, Madam Chairman and members of the committee here, that we will see a tremendous increase in cost of campaign as state monies are being used. There's a direct relationship. And if you go over the history of it from the Department of Revenue over the years, as we funneled out more and more monies, as the legislators themselves and PAC groups have found ways to raise money using the state coffers to reimburse people, there is your significant reason for increasing costs. The more practical ways of decreasing cost of political campaign, one would be to do what the Supreme Court has recommended for other reasons, single-member districts. This would keep a legislator within that neighborhood. It would keep them in a much smaller region. You take Anchorage, you won't have to buy TV. You won't have to buy mass media. You take the Mat-Su area. Now with the Donut District, it's very costly for them to get around. I guess it stretches almost 600 miles in one direction. So by single-member district, you will decrease the cost of campaigning. Madam Chairman, in your district, I'm sure you saw that increase. And there's just no reason for it, except politically we find out this may be better. Sticking directly to the bill, the first thing I noticed, I think it's a rule, at least we had it for the last 2 years, that you must accompany a bill with a fiscal note, even if it's zero. In this case here, Madam Chairman, I believe because of what Representative Miller just said in relationship to monitoring PAC groups, it is going to be a significant increase in cost to APOPs. It's going to be a significant increase in cost to the Division of Department of Revenue because they're going to have to funnel those checks out. Somehow, however, they're going to have to monitor what that person gave to. And then if they gave to a PAC, did it filter down to another candidate, and then that person being reimbursed twice. So an awful lot of paperwork, and I'm going to give you some statistics later, Madam Chairman, to show you how cumbersome that this bill will be. The few other words on line one, line 10, the first word that's really used that needs to be clarified is residents. I think since 1972, there's been at least 10 cases that I know of where candidates have been challenged on their true residency. And in this past election, both Democrats and Republicans, in my mind, really absolutely cheated on the law of what we meant by residency, being in your district by 1 year. And I have no qualms on my Republican members as well as Democrat members. I believe they absolutely cheated. The trouble is that you can cheat and get away with it because no one has the authority to verify residency. The Division of Election only certifies they gave us this slip of paper. We do not have the authority. The Attorney General says they don't have the authority. Every other department who has residency requirements also has the responsibility of enforcement of residency, except for politicians with little golden angels here. The Department of Revenue, Department of Law also needs to have authority to prosecute when a candidate lied about their residency. They don't have that authority now, and they made it very clear.
Can I interrupt just make one point? I think Ms. Martin's perhaps misreading that first sentence. This doesn't refer to the resident candidate. It refers to the resident individual who makes a contribution. So the problem you're discussing may or may not be real.
Okay, then we'll take it down.
But it's not doesn't have anything to do with this bill.
Okay, stand corrected there, but later on when we get into the residency of the candidate, it's assumed, and so therefore it may be misused. In other words, that needs to be clarified is line 17. We use entitled to credit. There is no credit now. No one pays personal income tax. It should be a refund. And I think that a lot of people are really being misled on that word, credit and versus refund. And I think that we should be direct. This is a giveaway in which a person can make as much as 50% profit within 6 months. And I say that deliberately because I won't use the individual's name, but there were some letters that were very strong this year to people loan me $100 and I will guarantee you 50% increase on your interest. That's nothing to do with supporting that candidate. It's strictly a money deal. So people are misusing it to gather money. We also want to, I think what this would do is entice a lot of non-serious candidates in line 15 and 16. If you're going to go through this, make a division truly between the primary candidate and the general candidate. Because I think that we're enticing an awful lot of people. You can make a good business off this. You have 100 people, 1,000 people that you can continuously see each year to rotate that $100. They make $50 on it on their income tax. Plus next year you give it back to they give it back to you, and then they make another $100. In the meantime, in 10 years you have made $1,000 as a businessman on that $100 contribution. They have made $500 in interest just on rotating that $100. So it's a good business gimmick, and sometimes if the people continuously do this, I may become a non-serious candidate and raise an awful lot of money and keep it. It was mentioned earlier by Mrs. Comstock, and she's right here. I'm sorry. Line 21, all expenditures. The expenditures that legislators are putting down now are absolutely wild. People are making trips to Hawaii, they're making trips to the Southern 48, they're making trips all over the place in between primary and general elections and after the general election for a vacation. Is that legitimate? People are using their money for loans, absolutely. And you can see from the APOC's records where they had paid off their loans. I don't know what that loan was in the first place. So this had to be clarified. From 18 to 23, those lines where we're limiting campaign, I think, Madam Chairman, that the case law this summer that was passed by the U.S. Supreme Court says that we cannot do this. We cannot limit freedom of speech, Article 1. And that's what you do by limiting the campaign candidates. This would be in the Buckley versus Valeo case.
Madam Chairman, excuse me, Terry. There was one thing I wanted to remind you of. We've got a teleconference at 4:30, and there's the chairman, and I think it's about three or four of us on the asbestos abatement. Excuse me, I just wanted to make sure we had enough time to get up to finance before.
Okay.
Just two more statements, Madam Chairman.
I don't want to cut you off, Martin. Go ahead, I'll stay here.
Okay, you
know what? I'm sure I will.
And here in subsection B, line 24, we're asking for the candidates to declare themselves. And I'm afraid that you really might put that individual in a real problem. They're going to say this type of candidate versus that. Should it be a scam candidate? A scam candidate is the state candidate on the lasting monies. Or you can call it a rump candidate running on public monies. Now, they're going to be labeled almost immediately. Now, I'm not so sure anybody wants that label, even though they want the money. Then you have the other guy saying, hey, look, I'm free and innocent. I believe those money should be used for the child that's starving and for shoes for the one that has cold feet. So we're going to end up with labeling here those who say they voluntarily limit their campaign expenditures. I agree with Representative Miller. The most I've ever spent was $40,000, and I got a fairly large double district. We probably knocked it out. This year, I only spent $22,000. The guy right next to me, Republican, spent almost $110,000. Almost outrageous when the U.S. was a Republican, it was felt he had it made. So why do people get themselves in this phobia atmosphere that they need more and more money? Money is the answer to win. And I would agree it's not to. The people will judge the character. I don't think public funding is the answer.
Any questions?
Madam Chairman, I want to apologize.
May we take this that Theda has, or should that go?
No, we have to make a copy of it for you.
I've got it.
You can take it. Representative Martin, do you have some more? You have some
Madam Chairman, I know you're in a hurry, and I'm willing to cut. If I can come back later, we'd like to discuss three other forms.
We're going to have another. This is only the beginning of
this. Yeah, let me come back later today.
Yes,
I have some more detailed information.
So that we can have questions, and I apologize for...
Oh, I understand. Well, that was the point I was trying to make. Did not cut it off. Can we just...
But we'll reschedule it, and I'll let you know in plenty of time. some material that you want the committee to have, you could leave it with the staff and they can make copies for them.
Sure. We'll do that, Madam Chairman, that way you have something.
Representative Miller has one more comment, I think.
I just want to make one comment in closing. I welcome the representative's critique of the bill, and I found it valuable. I would like to say, however, that at least 70% of his comments were not directed at this bill, but were directed at the campaign credit statutes that are on the bill. They're already on the, if he wants to introduce legislation repealing those, as he's done in the past, that's a perfectly legal thing to do. But that really doesn't have anything to do with this bill. This bill is a constitutional, it passes constitutional muster because it's only dealing with that portion of the monies that are, you know, state monies. The Constitution has very clearly said that you can limit spending if you're limiting spending of public monies. But most of the comments were directed not at this bill, but at the basic campaign credit legislation, which is certainly fair game for him if he wants to introduce a repeal. But there's nothing we can do with this piece of paper that will accomplish what he wants to do.
No. Chairman, thank you, and I will elaborate on that statement.
Thanks.
I think it's a direct relationship.
Thank you, Representative. The House State Affairs Committee is adjourned at 4:00.